This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago. It's exactly 12 noon. Stay with us now as 98.7 WFMT brings you Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a monthly series presenting interviews with authors conducted before a live audience. It's a unique collaborative effort of Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT, and Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Victoria Lautman's guest today is author Michael Cunningham, whose latest of many novels is Specimen Days. Cunningham won the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for his book The Hours, and also wrote A Home at the End of the World and Flesh and Blood. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater and to Victoria Lautman and Michael Cunningham.
Thank you. Thank you, and welcome, everybody, to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a collaborative effort of Chicago Magazine, 98.7 WFMT Radio, set here at our host, the Looking Glass Theater, where I am on the set of Hillbilly Antigone, a fantastic show with original music. This is our final event in our inaugural season of Writers on the Record, and maybe some of you have been here for, I know some of you have, for some of the earlier ones. We started with Edward P. Jones. We went to Susan Orlean, Augustine Burroughs, Alexander Heyman, Francine Prose, Jonathan Safran Foer, Sue Miller. You know, we've had a pretty amazing lineup this year, and culminating with the amazing Michael Cunningham, whom I will introduce in just a minute. I want to remind you that we will be taking questions at the end, so start thinking of them now. And we will be selling books at the end of this. There will be a break. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun today. I was thinking of what the right way was to introduce Michael Cunningham, whom I've had the pleasure of interviewing twice before. And I was thinking, you know, if this man were a stock, for instance, that was traded on the New York Stock Exchange, just to commodify him for a moment, and you invested in this stock 20 years ago when his very first now out-of-print book came out in 1984, which was called Golden States. It's out of print, but you can get a copy for $200 on the Internet. if you invested in the Michael Cunningham stock 20 years ago when it was just making its appearance on the stock market, let's say a tiny blip, not even a ripple really, and then something like 6 years went by and his next book, the next stock, came out, which was in 1990, A Home at the End of the World, which became a movie later on with Colin Farrell, stock begins to creep up. Your investment is beginning to show some rewards. Maybe not dividends yet, but 1995, Flesh and Blood came out. It's being made into a miniseries for Showtime, I believe. The stock is really doing pretty well at that point. You know, you've made a good investment. It's performing. You know, maybe you're not getting great dividends yet, but you've made a pretty solid investment. And then in 1998, your stock goes big time, and you are a smart investor because Michael Cunningham publishes The Hours, which at the time he felt his family members would read, and it would then go on to the remainder desk, which we know was not the case. It became a Pulitzer Prize, huge bestseller. Everybody read it. Then everybody saw the movie. And you were a smart investor with huge dividends pouring in at that point. And the dividends in this stock are continuing with Specimen Days. And it's such a pleasure to welcome Michael Cunningham. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Kind of a hokey introduction, but, you know.
No, I love
an analogy.
No, I love an analogy. Analogies are my business.
Yes, that is true. And because Specimen Days only came out on Tuesday, and so most of you probably have not had a chance to read it yet, without going into too many of the details myself, I mean, I can say three novellas or short stories intertwined, three characters that keep reappearing, three time periods that are taking place in New York City. What do you tell people this is a book about?
Oh, I am finding it really difficult to produce a sound bite about this particular book.
You have more time today, though.
I love that. It's an especially difficult book to talk about. It starts during the Industrial Revolution in New York in the 1860s with a sort of Victorian ghost story. about a very odd little boy who believes that the spirits of the dead go into machinery. It goes on to the present day, a thriller set just after 9/11, and that one is about a woman who is trying to track down a band of child terrorists. I mean children who are terrorists. And the last one is set in the future, and, well, there's just no delicate way to put it. It's about an android in love with a lizard from another planet. I very much wanted to create my first, what I hoped would be, compelling, believable, non-human character. I'm done with gay. I've gone to interspecies.
I was really curious to hear how you would put it, because reviewers have either seen this as three separate novellas or three separate stories that are loosely linked. But in fact, what links all three of these stories together are the characters, Luke, Simon, and Catherine, or Kat, or Katarine, who reappear through time, mm-hmm. through their bond with one another. And the other leitmotif, the thing that is linking the book, which really gave its title to this, is Walt Whitman. Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting that you chose Specimen Days as the title, because that was the title of Walt Whitman's, not Leaves of Grass, but his 1882 sort of autobiographical essays, which he said at the beginning of, "I shall send out the most wayward, spontaneous, fragmentary book ever printed."
And succeeded in doing so.
And I also realized that how clever it was of you, besides being a brilliant writer, how clever it was of you to now be linked for all time over the internet and Google with two of the most important writers ever. If you Google Virginia Woolf, The Hours, Mrs. Dalloway, up comes Michael Cunningham. Mm-hmm. If you Google Walt Whitman, Specimen Days, Leaves of Grass, up comes Michael Cunningham.
Yeah,
you're smart.
I thought so. You know, when I made a bundle off Virginia Woolf, and then I realized no one had done Whitman yet. No, that is a joke. Please don't write.
That is a joke.
No, angry emails or calls are not necessary. I did not intend. I actually not only don't intend to exploit either of these great figures, I had no intention of following up one novel with a great literary genius at its center with another novel with another great literary figure at its center. I sort of feel like, you remember that Monty Python routine? Nobody, I wasn't expecting the Spanish Inquisition. No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Well, I wasn't expecting Walt Whitman.
Well, and each of the characters in all three of the stories uses Walt Whitman in a very different way. And maybe we should start out with the first story, In the Machine, where Luke, who is a character who keeps reappearing as a misshapen, strange poetry, the first one anyway, poetry spouting child, a 12-year-old. He morphs over the course of the other two stories. But the first time we see him is in the Machine, where his brother, the provider for the family at that point, Simon, has mm-hmm. died, a victim of the Industrial Revolution. He is actually killed by the machine that he's working on, which then Luke goes and takes over. Luke falls in love with Catherine, the much older fiance of his brother. And actually, you know, when you started to write this book, part of what you were reacting to, really, it wasn't so much about Whitman or even about Virginia Woolf, but the idea of high literature versus low literature and deciding to write ghost story, thriller, sci-fi.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because I have always loved ghost stories, thrillers, and science fiction. I have always read promiscuously, though I'm quite restrained in all my other habits.
I see you lowered your voice when you said that.
Did you notice that? That's because you're a trained professional and you can spot these things. You know, I've always read all over the map, and because I do that, I know that there are works of true brilliance over in the, shall we say, not serious section of the bookstore and the library. And all of my friends are serious readers, and not one of them has read Samuel Delaney, William Gibson, Ursula K. Le Guin, and all of them have read certain tepid, thinly veiled autobiographies because they're in the serious section. And I wanted to do something with my love for the quote-unquote less serious stuff, the genre stuff, which I think has huge possibilities.
Did you actually think at any point, well, they won't know where to put this?
I hoped they wouldn't know where to put it. I mean, I think one of my great ambitions as a novelist is to someday write a book that they will have no idea where to put.
Well, having said that, I would love for you to read. I mean, the thing that is really remarkable, I think, about this book is that for anybody who's read, if the only book they've read is The Hours, great, but Flesh and Blood, A Home at the End of the World, the language is so beautiful, and the way that you imagine things, the visual component of your writing is extraordinary. And that we can see it in this book in your voice, but in three styles across time, is just a remarkable thing. I want you to actually read from the first of these. Do you call them novellas? I mean, it seems kind of weird.
I think of them as novellas, and yet that implies that the book is made up of three entirely separate entities, which is not true. It's a novel in three parts.
That sounds good. Okay, and you're reading
sections
from In the Machine, and this is, maybe you can set this up with Luke a little bit.
Yeah. Luke.
Lucas.
Lucas is a poor Irish boy in New York in the 1860s, at a time when America and New York in particular was just being flooded with Irish immigrants from the after the potato famine, and they were subjected to this. I use this term advisedly because it's very different now, but to a kind of racism. They were the lowest of the low. You couldn't be worse than Irish, and they were widely believed to be genetically inferior. And Lucas, who is an odd boy, deformed, more than a little bit delusional, is reading and sort of absorbing Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And at moments of high excitement, he develops a sort of Tourette's-like symptom and actually spouts out lines from Walt Whitman, which sometimes prove to be prophetic. And his older brother, Simon, the sole support of the family, has been sort of sucked into the machine at the ironworks where he had been working. And as recompense, they have offered Lucas, the sole surviving son, his job at the machine. Remind me where you wanted, what
it's
line?
It's marked there, down at the bottom, at the works.
At the works, thank you. And remind me where, my copy just isn't marked.
If you remind here,
me
where take it, where this one. Said. I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong one.
Let's trade copies.
I don't want you to
yours
guess.
Has the marks.
You might be reading all day. Okay.
Once the old thing gets started. Oh, just another page. They'll want to hear a little more. It's still Sunday, right? At the works, Lucas had to struggle to pay proper attention. His mind wanted to wander. He aligned a plate, pulled the lever, and then was at the back of the machine inspecting the impressions with no memory of having gotten there. It was dangerous, a dangerous condition to bring to the machine, and yet he could not seem to do otherwise. Trying to think only of his work, align, clamp, pull, pull again, inspect, was like trying to remain awake when sleep was overwhelming. Inattention took him like dreams. To steady himself, he set his mind to the whisper in the machine. He listened carefully. It might have been the squeak of an unoiled bearing, but it sounded more like a voice, a tiny voice, though its words were indistinguishable. It had the rhythm of a voice, the rise and fall and rise again, suggesting intention rather than accident. the tone implying a certain urgency, more human than mechanical, as if the sound were being made by some entity struggling to be heard. Lucas knew well enough what it was to speak a language no one understood. He fed it another plate, and another, and another. The nature of the machine's song didn't disclose itself until afterward. The song wasn't sung in language, not in a language Lucas recognized, but gradually, over time, the song began making itself clear, even though its words remained obscure. It was his brother's voice. Could it be? Lucas listened more carefully. Simon's voice had been deep and raucous. He had sung not well, but with bravado, with the rampant, soaring tunelessness of someone who cared less about sounding beautiful than about creating a sound big enough to reach the sky. This seemed, in fact, to be Simon's voice, rendered mechanical. It had that reckless, unapologetic atonality. The song was familiar. Lucas had heard it elsewhere, at a time and place that hovered on the outer edge of memory. It was a song of melancholy and yearning. A sad song full of loneliness and a thread of hope. It was one of the old ballads. Simon had known hundreds of them. Simon was imprisoned in the machine. It made sudden, dreadful sense. He was not in heaven or in the pillow. He was not in the grass or in the locket. His ghost had snagged on the machine's inner workings. The machine held it as a dog might hold a man's coat in its jaws after the man himself had escaped. Simon's flesh had been stamped and expelled, but his invisible part remained, trapped among the gears and teeth.
Michael Cunningham reading from Specimen Days.
Oh, thank you.
You paint such a accurate, Dickensian, dark, awful portrait of what life was like for this group of people, that class working then in New York. And when Lucas meets up with his hero, the one book he's ever read and owned, Walt Whitman in the street, and they have a conversation, and you realize that Walt Whitman is setting the tone really for what happens in the rest of the stories in the book. Walt Whitman, and to a certain extent poetry, becomes an escape. It becomes a portal to another way of life.
Absolutely, absolutely. When I was doing the research for the first part, I wanted to get 1865 New York as accurately as I could. I learned quickly that for most people, unless you were very rich, it was an extremely difficult place. People worked 6 and even 7 days in factories, 12 to 14-hour shifts. There were no regulations. There was a sort of red-gray, coal smoke-laden sky that hovered about 20 feet over everybody's head. There was no garbage pickup, except in the better neighborhoods. If a horse died in front of your building, there it stayed, and you just sort of walked around it for a very long time. And I was also aware that walking through all of this was Walt Whitman, our great transcendental poet, our own whirling dervish, saying, "I find this all beautiful." It's not that beauty is absent. It's that we need a new way of looking at what's here. And I just loved it. I have no theories about why this particular dark place and time should help produce one of our great immaculate spirits, but I couldn't help but notice the coincidence. And so I put him in. And then if Walt Whitman was going to be in one story, it seemed that he had to be in all three. And he metamorphosed into the soul of the book, if you will. It's inner juice. It's part that always loves the world no matter what happens.
Well, and by the time we get to the third story, and we won't talk about that yet particularly, but you realize that there's really more at stake. It's the idea that, I suppose, that some things can really last. Some things can make a difference. Some things can last hundreds of years and give hope even to somebody not human.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's a pretty utopian vision.
Yeah. Well, I'm only interested in what lasts. No, that's not true. I'm interested in everything. But I guess...
But it sounded good.
Yeah, I know. Hey, it's something to say. No, I guess you would have to say I'm interested in the contrast and the confluence between that which fades, most notably us, and that which remains, that which lives on after us, whether it's our children or a Bach cantata or a cathedral.
Well, is that sort of what the impetus was between, there were certain objects in certain places in this book that keep, they're like time markers.
Yeah.
They're things that follow from the first story to the last. And one in particular, which I'm not giving anything away here, I don't think, is a white porcelain bowl, which has some markings on it, which in a language which I'd love for you to actually tell me what that is, if there is something specific. But the bowl, which Lucas buys in the first story and then is found some actually at the same store in the second story and then mysteriously turns up in Denver in the third story. In certain places in Central Park, certain characters besides the three main characters, this continuity of objects, it's almost like you were in places. What is a tragedy in the first story, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory disaster, although it's not called that, becomes, you know, just another condo loft development in story number two. And
you
do seem very interested in peeling away layers and showing us how history builds on itself, how past is prologue.
Yeah, 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 that's absolutely right. I can't improve on that.
Long-winded questions answer itself.
I did want, in addition to the sort of mutable spirit of Walt Whitman, who appears in the guise of a woman in the second part and a mythical scientist in the third part, I wanted an actual physical object to survive. And there's no way to say this without sounding just horribly pretentious, but I wanted it to be a grail. I wanted it to be a holy vessel. And I don't think it's giving away too much or, well, what the hey. It also seemed important that at the end, this bowl revealed to be entirely worthless. And the cryptic message, which I decided at the end not to translate, but it's a souvenir from Eastern Europe from 200 years ago, and it says something. It says, you know, "Eat a Joe's."
It does.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's not the bowl itself that matters. It's the act of keeping the bowl and passing
it
along,
it down.
And having it to actually take to another planet at the end.
There's the place in Central Park of the statue. What is that? What is that called again?
The Angel of Bethesda.
Right, exactly. I mean, you could have chosen so many different places, and Central Park becomes such an important feature in the book. It's a place that in the first story Lucas has never experienced. He has like an epiphany there. He really feels the poetry of Walt Whitman for the first time. In the second one, it's less important somehow. But in the third one, which we'll talk about after the break, but is there a reason why you're particularly drawn to that? I mean, you could have chosen so many different places in the city. Why Central Park?
Well, Central Park is the heart of New York City to me. New York City is deeply a city built around a park. Central Park actually began as a sort of right-wing triumph. The more liberal idea as New York was expanding northward in the mid-1800s was that there'd be a lot of small local parks. And the conservatives really won and said, no, there'll be a great big park way up there that poor people can't get to. And there won't be any parade grounds. There won't be any gaming fields. There won't be the things that someone like my character Lucas or his brother Simon would have enjoyed. It's going to be an area for the wealthy to promenade in. So Central Park is actually a sort of loaded symbol in and of itself. It's a big, beautiful thing that was built for the wealthy, and I simply love Bethesda Fountain. It was the first major commission for an outdoor sculpture given to a woman. It was despised by critics, who are almost always wrong about everything, for being insufficiently ethereal and angelic. And though I worry that angels are just tapped out, that you just can't write since Tony Kushner and you know, and uncountable Hallmark cards, you just can't write another angel. I just love that angel too much. It's my last angel, I promise.
We don't mind if you contribute a few more. The place of kids in this book, I just realized when I'm thinking about Lucas and then the Children's Crusade and then what happens in the third story where a real family comes together in the most strange circumstances imaginable. But that I don't remember you actually writing about kids quite as much as you did in this book. And I'm curious about that.
Well, children are hard to write about. They are mostly acted upon by adults. And I think when you write about a young child, you are by definition not only writing about that sort of, that deeply mysterious person, but writing about that person's parents and the agents who are so very much in control of his or her life. You notice that the great kids in literature, like Huck Finn and Holden Caulfield, essentially have no parents. One is an orphan, the other's parents I don't think ever appear. Children are just hard to do, and I have written about a child, but I mean him as a kind of holy fool. He's malformed, he's variously inspired and deranged, and a genius in the last one.
Murderous in the second.
He's a murderer in the second, though he doesn't quite understand the harm he's doing. Yeah, he's a child, but I think of him more as one of those kind of alarming children in medieval paintings. That look like
the Peter Bruckle,
terrifying little adults. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they're babies because their heads are a little too big, but otherwise.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and come back in just a minute and talk about some more, really what happens in the third story, which to my mind was one of the most interesting way it ties together. Michael Cunningham, Specimen Days. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 98.7 WFMT and to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a monthly series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. We hope you'll stay tuned at 1 for Chicago Symphony Retrospective, hosted by Don Tate, and then at 3:30, the Orchestra, an American Specialty. Bill McLaughlin talks with Joe Horowitz about the heyday of the symphony orchestra in the United States in the first half of the 20th century, with rare recordings as well. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place once a month, Sundays at noon at the Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman will take place, following a summer hiatus, on Sunday, September 18th, when Victoria's guest will be Brett Easton Ellis, author of Lunar Park. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, admission is free. Call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Welcome back. Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, talking to Michael Cunningham today. I want to remind you that this is the last in our series that's been ongoing since September, our inaugural series, and we are going to take a two-month break and come back starting in September with Brett Easton Ellis and his new book, Lunar Park. That's on September 18th. Then Louise Erdrich in October and Frank McCourt in November. So it's been a great first year, and to culminate with Michael Cunningham, I mean, how great is that? Wow. The third story in Specimen Days was the one that was, I could imagine, the most of a stretch for you and the most fun to write. This is the one that you will read it and think of Blade Runner, artificial intelligence, AI, you might think of, Ursula Le Guin, Ray Bradbury. I mean, there are all these references. Delaney, you mentioned him. There's so many references to other types of science fiction. And as you say, to read something that is so beautifully written, but so completely different from everything that you've done before. And I know that you wanted to push the envelope with every book you've written, and particularly after The Hours and the Pulitzer Prize. Was this one particularly hard for you, or did it come as easily and as naturally as the previous two installments in the book?
No, it was hard for me. As you mentioned, I always want to feel at least a little bit incompetent at what I'm doing. Only because I feel like once you start to feel like an expert, something begins to die. You should always feel, as a writer, I think, a little out of your depth. And writing a science fiction story, on one hand, what's not to like about getting to invent a world and people it with lizard-like immigrants from another planet? I was also very much aware that I was an amateur working in an exalted tradition, though not exalted by all, but hugely respected by the people who read it, and that it was quite presumptuous of me what am I, a mainstream writer, a naturalistic writer, to sort of take a crack at a form like science fiction, which writers I respect enormously have been doing beautifully for their entire careers. So I was nervous, but I find it easiest to be nervous about just about everything.
Well, you this is the only story of the three where the three characters actually all come together in a different form. Simon is now a simulo, a cyborg, with a poetry chip embedded in him. So he actually is not unlike Lucas. He's spouting poetry, Walt Whitman, and he can't help it.
Yeah.
And it's a way of making him more human. And he, as you say, is drawn to this character, Anadian. You've created this race of immigrants from another planet, refugees, and turned the whole idea, in a way, of the future on its head, although it is Gibson-like in that it's just decayed. Simulo is working as a faux mugger in old New York, which is like the Epcot Center of New York City at that point. New York has just become a theme park, and New Jersey's a toxic wasteland. And so this Simulo gets to pretend to mug people in various stages. Some of it can be pretty rough and sort of sexual. But every day he sees this Nadian, this woman, Katerine, mm-hmm. Why don't you just read from the first part of this? Because that will actually clue, why am I saying this? You say it better in your darn book. This is actually the start of the chapter.
Author is not always the best authority about his own book. But this is the opening of the third and last part, which is called Like Beauty. She might have been beautiful. Beautiful was, of course, an approximation, an earthly term. The nearest word in her language was kirim, which more or less meant better than useful. It was as close as her people came to a lofty abstraction. The bulk of their vocabulary pertained to weather conditions, threats of various kinds, and that which could be eaten, traded, or burned for fuel. She was, by Earth standards, a 4.5-foot-tall lizard, with prominent nostrils and eyes slightly smaller than golf balls. But Simon believed she might have been glorious on her own planet. She might have been better than useful there. He saw her every evening, walking the children through the park. She always came at the same time, just after his shift started. She was modest but certain in her movements. Her skin was emerald. It had a clean, gem-like shine rare among the Nadians. Most were mossier looking. Their skins were more mottled, prone to splotches of ochre and dark brown. This was why people insisted that they were oily and that they smelled. They were not oily. They did not smell. Well, they did not smell bad. All creatures smelled. The Nadian smell was sweet and cleanly fermented. Most people never got close enough to know that. The children, both blonde, appeared to love her. Human children tended to love them, especially the younger ones. She guided her two small blondes along the pathway of the park with competence. She spoke softly to them. She sang intermittently that low whistling sound they all made, a five-note progression, eum, fa, so. Were the Nadians affectionate? It was a subject of continuing debate. Did they love human beings, or was it simplicity tinged with desperation? The children didn't seem to care. He watched her as she guided them toward his bench. The older one, a boy, probably four, ran ahead. He would find something, a stone, a leaf, and bring it back to her. He and she would examine it, confer quietly about its worth. The rejects were tossed back. The others she slipped into the pocket of her cape. As soon as a decision had been made, the boy went off in search of a new prize, tireless as a spaniel. This was witnessed with skeptical interest by the little girl, no more than three, who kept herself close to the Nadian. She toyed with the hem of her nanny's cape. Occasionally, she reached up and took hold of the long, thin fingers of an emerald hand. She appeared unconcerned about the two-inch pewter-colored nails. When the nanny and the children were both within earshot, Simon said, "Hey." He'd been saying hey to her for several days now. It had been incremental. No acknowledgement, then a smile and a nod, then a greeting. Today she responded. "Bochum," she said. Her voice was soft. It had that whistle. She sounded like a flute that could speak.
For a writer who has so consistently managed to nail the idea of the outsider and how the outsider functions or doesn't function in society, you know, you put together a trio in this story in particular that is unbeatable. When they take one of the strangest road trips of all time, you know, eating irradiated vermin and searching for salvation in Denver, you know, we've got this, you know, Simulo, somebody from another planet, and again, Lucas, who appears as demented but really funny and quite amusing at this point. Mm-hmm. Boy, I mean, this is a family that you seem to be creating and recreating in all your books. How do we make family? How does love continue across gender, species? It doesn't matter, but it's there.
You know, it's one of those things that keeps coming up. And I have to say that it's not intentional. One of my ideas in this book, there only seemed to be two things that were of paramount importance. Well, three things. It must be unlike the hours, ergo, it must not contain a literary great. And
failed.
Enough with the family stuff. It can't be about family anymore. And they're failed. And I think some of these things are in your DNA as a writer. There are certain themes and certain concerns that you just get back to, despite your best efforts to leave them. I mean, in a way, it's like being stuck with your family. You could disavow them. You can move to another country, and yet you're still stuck with each other in some way.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up because I was thinking about this and reading, obviously, a lot about what was going on during the time of this book and when you wrote The Hours and when The Hours then came out as a movie. And there are two scenes specifically in this book that are so touching. Well, really, and it's about death. It's about caring for somebody that you love.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first story, it's really Lucas is caring for his mother. And in the third one, it's, I won't go into that. You can read the book. But I realized that your mother, who was a very important force in your life, had died in 2002. And there was a very touching story about how she was not going to live to see The Hours come out as a movie. She got to see you get the Pulitzer. And that Scott Rudin, the producer, very kindly brought over some footage. So your mother watched it on the last day that she was actually really compos mentis.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me that so much, particularly in this book, is about carrying on from death, about what continues. I don't know how spiritual you are, maybe not at all, but so much about this book seems to be about how do we find each other.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think part of what drove this book was the experience of I'm not quite sure how to put it, trying to help my mother die. I always worry a little bit when I talk about my mother that I'm going to seem more like Tony Perkins in Psycho than I would quite like to. But I think one's parent, to use a horribly shop-worn phrase, one's primary caregiver, in rare instances it is a father or some other person, but the person who kind of kept you alive during those early days is simply the main god in your personal pantheon, whether that person is a good god or an evil god or a more ambiguous kind of god. And this book, if The Hours was to some degree my attempt to tell her via a novel that her life hadn't been wasted, hadn't been misspent, she was, at least to one person in the world, every bit as monumental as Emma Bovary or Anna Karenina, I think this book may be in some way about sort of putting her to rest, especially that last part, which we can't really talk about because it would give things away.
That you're giving them even more incentive now to run out there and buy the darn book. Well, before we take some questions in another few minutes, there's other things that we didn't get to about this chapter, like the fact that you really did invent a Nadian language. Well, 50 words of it.
Yeah.
You have
yeah.
a conversation going.
I do. I actually know about 100 words of Nadian. I only used about 50.
You've increased your vocabulary
I devised a vocabulary of about 100 words. I think a better crackpot would actually have developed an entire Nadian language. I didn't go that far.
You could have hired a Trekkie.
It's vaguely derived from Portuguese. And yeah, there is actually a Nadian language.
It sounds Italian. I realize you wrote that chapter in Italy, staying at the villa mm-hmm. of some very important person, and you actually made some comment about this little lizard that visited you every day.
Well, I was interested in trying to create a compelling, believable, non-human, an alien, and not just a person with green skin, but somebody more foreign than that. And my idea, as you point out, it's the future, but nothing really works very well. All the marvels are here, but they're all breaking down. Look, my cell phone barely works at all. And we have finally made contact for the first time with an alien civilization. But as it turns out, all of our ideas about vastly advanced technologies and spiritualities were wrong. They're poorer and more desperate than even the poorest people of Earth. And they can't wait to come to Earth, where they are given only the lowliest jobs and treated with utter disdain. And I was casting around in my mind for what kind of beings these people would be. And I had a table near a window overlooking a valley in Tuscany where I had my laptop, and every day the most beautiful little green-brown lizard would sort of dart back and forth, and I just kept looking at her. It's hard to sex a lizard if you're not an expert, but I thought of her as a woman lizard. And she was so graceful and beautiful and full of her own inscrutable intention, off about her own impenetrable business, impenetrable to me. And I had a kind of, I loved her. Though, of course, she didn't care about me.
She doesn't call, she doesn't write.
She doesn't call, she doesn't write. But you know what I mean, that sense of a clear intelligence and some kind of creaturely complexity that bore no relationship to mine was exactly what I was looking for. And so I based Katerine to some extent on that Italian lizard.
I'm so glad it wasn't a termite you saw every day.
It could just as easily. I would have worked with the termite if I needed to.
If anybody does have questions, this is a good time to maybe start lining up down here by one of the two microphones. because we will take your questions as long as they're good ones and short, or a little short. If they're bad ones, we'll cut you off. You know, you are continuing with your Hollywood dance in a way. I mean, you wrote the screenplay for – oh, he winced. You wrote the screenplay for A Home at the End of the World. You did not write the screenplay for The Hours, and I know that this book has been sold again to Scott Rudin. Or was it optioned? It was sold.
Optioned. Yeah.
So we may be seeing it as a movie that is going to require a lot more than a prosthetic nose on Nicole Kidman. But you're actually writing a screenplay for Julia Roberts right now. And it's not your book. It's a whole different kind of world for you now.
Yeah. The movie thing has just sort of happened without my looking for it. I adapted a wonderful book by Susan Minot called Evening, which I'm very much hoping we're going to start filming this summer, directed by John Coulette, the guy who did that documentary called Tarnation, about his schizophrenic mother. It's Hollywood. That may or may not happen, but I did that. And then, you know, every time I finish a novel, I'm full of adrenaline. I don't want to take a vacation, nor can I possibly start another novel. I have no idea what it would be. So what do I do with all this energy? And I just sent out a silent prayer to whoever might be listening that something will come up. And these prayers are consistently answered, this time in the form of a call from Universal asking if I wanted to adapt a novel called Good Grief, the title of which I'd like to change, for Julia Roberts. And I said, I don't know. I read the book. It was a little bit of a feel-good book, and I'm all for feeling good, but how to put this? I know our human striving towards some kind of happiness and some kind of peace is enormously difficult and elusive and hard on us. And one of the things that I respect most about us as a species is we struggle for happiness for ourselves and for the people we love. And any book that portrays it as cheap and easy feels insulting to me, you know? When you meet the perfect guy or girl, when you start a little business and it just booms, I just feel like, I mean, it's a nice fantasy, but it's not a fantasy. I'm interested in bigger struggles than that. So I said, look, I'm really going to screw this book up. And Universal said, well, duh, why do you think we called you? I talked to Julia. She said this. She and I were right there together. She said, "Look, I think maybe this woman should put on some weight as her life starts to work out better. Maybe I'll put on a few pounds, girl." and the great thrill has been, you know, I who live almost all my life alone in a room, like a figment of my own imagination, like Rapunzel in the tower, but without any kind of hair to hold out any hopes for rescue, you know. You're a novelist. You do what you do alone. And now suddenly I'm working with Julia, a hugely intelligent, intuitive person, to kind of create this character she will play. It's like we're collaborating on this person, and it's fantastic.
That is fantastic. And when do we hope to see this? Anytime that...
This is like the very early stages of this. It's very early. There's not even a finished screenplay yet. A year to two.
Well, I know that you're the guy who said yourself that you write optimistic novels full of death. And so the idea that you would then take this, you know, happy book and turn it, I mean, but that's the part in all of your work that I think people really respond to, is that and there is nobody who can write with absolute beauty about a mangled hand, which you do in this book. Or, I mean, you're like a poet of these just tragic, awful things. And when the suicide in The Hours, I mean, that is something which you do keep coming back to, is death, pain, but do it really well.
Thank you. And I'm interested in that which again, that which survives the worst that can happen to people. Otherwise it feels cheap.
Well, before you wrote Specimen Days and you needed to take time off from The Hours, you actually wrote a book which I haven't mentioned, but it's right here, Land's End.
Yeah, yeah.
A Walk in Provincetown. which was one of these kind of palate cleansers, I guess.
That was my rescue from the hours. Same prayer to the same unseen forces. The phone rang, and it was Random House. Did I want to write a little, not really a travel book so much as a travel meditation on a place that I loved? And I said, sure, Provincetown, Massachusetts. They paused on the phone because they had been thinking more like Paris or Rome. And
P-town.
I said, you know, no, but P-town is a place I know well enough to feel qualified to write about. What do I have to say about Paris that other people haven't said better already? And to their great credit, they not only let me do Provincetown, it was a series, and they've let people do like Oakland and Kingston, Jamaica, and all these places that are not supposed to have sort of lyrical meditations written about them. And I love them for that.
It's a great book, actually, if anybody is interested in reading about Provincetown. If you start looking at, do you read your reviews? I mean, have you been looking at them?
I try not to. They seep in. Oh, sure.
Well, it's actually really interesting. I mean, there haven't been a huge number of reviews. And you've said that after the hours, after the Pulitzer Prize, people are going to hate whatever you were going to do next. But the reviews have been, for the most part, very good. What's interesting to me is that you get incredible opposites. I mean, people have been saying, this is astonishing. It is his best book that he's ever written. You know, there's a lot of those. And there's been other people, one woman, like, horrible, she was wrong, but called that it was stilted, formulaic, patronizing. Why is it that this is patronizing? It was an online site.
Yeah.
I completely disagree. You have opened yourself up for a kind of level of criticism, which you obviously knew.
Yeah. I think, though, of course, one wants nothing but praise at some sort of level. In fact, a novel that doesn't draw passionate mixed responses probably isn't big enough and strange enough. You don't want people to say terrible things about like that about your book, but you understand that that's part of its life in the world.
Well, and it's not the first time.
Patronizing.
No, well, it was. I'm sorry. Did I do a bad thing by?
Oh, no. Believe me, if you can't take this kind of thing, you're in the wrong business as a novel writer.
Well, and you got that review from the New York Times from Michiko Kakutani back with Flesh and Blood. That was just, I mean, it was.
It was excoriating.
She said, "This guy can't write."
She said, "This guy can't write. This guy can't write." Thank you for bringing that up.
But I'm here to tell you she was wrong, and she's had to eat that review every day of her life since then.
You know, that was especially difficult. It was my first really, really bad review that was read by, I don't even want to think today how many people. You know, it's the New York Times.
It obviously did nothing to hurt you.
Well, here's what I'm getting at. It was a difficult time, of course, but I think in every writer's career, your worst fears are going to come true, and you survive them. And you see that you're okay, you're still writing, and I have a new project. When Michiko Kakutani dies, I intend to outlive her. I'm going to get into her funeral and slip a copy of Flesh and Blood into the casket with her. So that years from now, millennia from now, when the archaeologists dig her up, they'll say, this must have been her favorite book.
We have a question here. Thank you for being patient.
Both the hours and the book you've just written are in three parts, and both of them deal with, you know, a great writer. Can you talk about the fact that similarity between the two works?
Yeah, certainly. Well, certainly about the three parts. I mean, I think I probably talked about how Whitman entered in to some degree. The three thing, you know, I feel like at this point we live in the biggest world anyone has ever lived in. Just in terms of population, in terms of our access to information about who else is out there and what their lives are like. And for me, one story just doesn't feel like enough anymore. Not the way a story felt like enough to Jane Austen or George Eliot. It just doesn't feel, to me, like a sufficient response. 100 stories wouldn't feel sufficient, but one was like, oh, come on. Two has a kind of deadly symmetry. Three gets interesting. And I mean, I think there's three has a real history, whether it be the Holy Trinity, three acts in a play. Three comes up a lot. It's a great number. It can balance perfectly, like in an isosceles triangle. It can be completely out of balance and then find balance. I love three. It's my favorite number. What can I say?
We can't wait to read the next one. Have you got an idea? Is it going to have to do with Shakespeare? So when we Google, you know, the play of Shakespeare, up comes Michael Cunningham.
You know, I have a very larval idea in the back of my head, as I did with all the other books. And it's actually one of the only things I really can't talk about. But yes, I do know what I'm going to do next.
I think that, and I haven't brought this up at all because I don't want to be another one to like perpetuate this, but you were known pretty much as a gay writer. Mm-hmm. You've completely transcended that, do you feel now?
I hope so, without in any way undermining the fact that I am a gay American who writes. I mean, I don't want that to fade into the background. What I like is the idea, and what indicates to me that the endless efforts of countless people, gay and straight, to move things forward, is that it is possible by the year 2005 for a writer like me to be read as someone who is American, white, male, gay, tall, you know, all of these things affect what you write, and matter and don't matter. And gay just seems to have joined the list as opposed to being my singular identifying feature. And I think that's good for everybody.
Well, it's certainly been good for us who have invested in you. Back in 1984. I didn't read that one. I don't plan to buy it for $200 on the internet, but I will.
No, I'll get you a copy for free.
You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Laumann and Michael Cunningham. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Laumann, a contributor to WTTW 11 Chicago Tonight and Artbeat. Victoria Laumann has written articles for the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, The Reader, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She's been the author, the Chicago editor for Metropolitan Home, Art and Auction, and Architectural Record, and has also contributed pieces to many other magazines, including Interview, Elle Decor, and Architectural Digest. Writers on the Record now begins a summer hiatus. The program will return on September 18th. When Victoria's guest will be Brett Easton Ellis, author of Lunar Park. That's Sunday, September 18th at noon, live from the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks at 821 North Michigan. We invite you to tune in, or if you would like to be in the audience, you may reserve a free ticket by phoning 312-832-6789. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Jacqueline Russell, General Manager David Schmitz, and Director of Production Lee Potter Murray, and to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record, which has been directed by Louise Frank. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for the series is Victoria Laumann. You are listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago.